good morning. This is Glenn Coble, and we're on the air here. That's the name of the show. You're on with Glenn Coble, and this morning we're going to have a guest, which we have on every, I think it's the third Thursday of every month. Maybe it's the second. We'll check with him in just a second. He's on the air. Let me grab him here. Fred, are you there?
I'm there. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm going to have to wait till my music's done.
Not a problem.
For some reason or other, my music has decided it's going to stay up loud. I haven't figured out how to turn that off yet. All right. Four more seconds, Fred, and we'll be right with you. All right. There we go. Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Not bad. Allergies are running amok.
They are.
No, my word. It was particularly bad in the earlier part of the week before we got the snowstorm.
Yeah, yeah.
The snowstorm has helped a little bit, but you'll have to excuse me if I'm a little froggy here this morning in the throat. That's where they seem to have concentrated on here recently, which I don't know whether that's better than all the constant sneezing or not. I haven't decided which one's worse.
I've had that. I've had the sneezing.
Well, I had it a week ago, and of course now I've got the eye watering that goes along with it. So,
well, we'll ask next Thursday. We have James Anderson on, our naturalist, and we'll ask him about those frogs. What we can do.
Oh yeah. Well, of course, right now the tree pollen is
it's terrible.
Bad, and it's all trees. It's not just one in particular, but. Yeah. We have a giant maple tree in our front yard, which I'm sure doesn't help the situation. And, of course, being out in the township, we're surrounded by a lot of trees. So
yeah, you
it doesn't
are.
Really make much difference.
Well, now, are you a gardener?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
No,
I was going to say that might do it.
My dad was a big gardener, loved to work in the yard and tend to the flowers and raise a garden, but I have no desire, no interest in doing that whatsoever.
I love it. I always love it at this time of the year. I get excited to put the seed in the ground. I get excited to see the little first green shoots pop up, and then the weeds come.
Yeah.
And I hate gardening once the weeds get there.
And that's the big kick of the whole thing.
Yeah, it is.
You have to fight those weeds all the time. And don't forget Natives in Harmony. I think we've talked about that before, and James has talked about that before.
Yeah.
That's Gail Martin's nursery over in Morrow County.
And, I wrote it down so I could get over there sometime this spring.
She specializes in native plants, native to Ohio, and does a really good job in that conservation effort. So
we like to support our local people in every way we
absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Well, as
did you
promised,
get your book read?
Well, yes. I got enough of it read to draw a conclusion.
Okay.
And as promised, we are going to talk about the H.L. Hunley this morning.
Okay.
I couldn't spend an entire hour and a half on the Hunley, so we're going to have the first half of the program, we're going to talk about the Hunley and a couple other things, and then in the second half of the program, I want to talk about some of America's forgotten history. I'm sure most of our listeners, at least those that are of our age bracket, are familiar with the Reader's Digest and the Saturday mm-hmm. Evening Post and
right.
Look at Life, the magazines that we read as kids, and especially the Reader's Digest. If you recall, Glenn, they had a section in there called America's Forgotten History.
Oh, I didn't remember.
And periodically, there would be an article in there about something that was kind of unknown, unless you were a real historian. And also, some of the other publications did the same thing. They also had one in there called My Most Unforgettable Character.
Hmm.
You remember either one of those?
I do not.
You're a Reader's Digest person.
I was not a Reader's Digest person, no.
Well,
my mother was.
They're kind of interesting, and over the years I've guarded some of those selections, and we're going to talk some about that and in the second half.
Okay.
But before we start talking about the Hunley, I wanted to mention a couple of things to the listeners. First of all, the Marion County Historical Society will be opening for the season on May 5th.
May 5th, excellent.
And
I'll write
that
down.
That's a Wednesday. This year we did not open in March for weekends like we normally do, simply because of the pandemic and trying to catch up. But we are going to be open with our regular hours starting on May 5th. That's on a Wednesday, and they'll run Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4, every day.
Wednesday.
And you'll be able to stop in, take the tour. And, of course, that includes admission to the Wyandotte Popcorn Museum as well, which a lot of people don't realize. There are two museums
right.
in our building. And, of course, we're located on Church Street. We're in the old post office building, the gigantic building that sits on the corner of State Street and Church Street.
What are the hours again?
1 to 4.
Okay.
1 to 4, Wednesday through Saturday.
Okay.
And again, that's
Wednesday
starting on May
5th. Saturday.
And you'll be able to tour both of the facilities. We always have a docent there that can either give you a guided tour, or some people like to tour the museum on their own. It's divided into two floors for those people that have never been there before. The main floor is where the post office conducted its majority of business with the public, where the lobby was. And then there's a downstairs that also has exhibits in it. So you get two floors. Plus, the Wind-Up Popcorn Museum is in the rear of the building, and that's under a giant circus tent, a full-size circus tent erected inside that building. And that's because of the efforts of George Brown and Wind-Up Popcorn Company that put that whole exhibit and that whole museum together.
Fantastic.
And it is, by the way, a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
But it is operated by the Wyandotte County Historical Society's staff and the Heritage Hall Museum. So,
fantastic.
We're grateful to them for having their museum being a part of ours.
Excellent, excellent. I've been in there twice, but I really haven't taken a full tour, so I'm going to have to do that.
Yeah, we have some very, very good qualified volunteers that have been working with us for a number of years, a lot of retired folks that give of their valuable time to do that, and it's a real service. And of course, we're always looking for more volunteers. And if you're not interested in being a docent or giving tours, there's also other things that can be done. There's research, obviously. There's always people that are requiring information and need research.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we always need lighthouse cleaning done periodically, dusting exhibits and washing glass. There's a lot of glass in there, obviously.
Yes, sir, yeah.
In cases. So there's always something to do. If you're interested in being a volunteer, you can contact the museum, stop there, or call the museum office Monday through Friday.
And the pay is gratitude.
387-4255.
I'm sorry. Say that number again.
387-4255. Obviously, it's a 740 number.
And you get paid oodles of gratitude.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's the best non-paying job you'll ever have.
I love it.
And you get to learn a lot about Marion's history.
Yeah, that would be good.
And that's a big part of it.
All right.
So I think that covers just about all of Marion County.
Okay.
Our friends to the north, the Wyandotte County Historical Society, of which I'm also a member,
mm-hmm.
Having their first open house of the season. That's going to be this Saturday on the 24th of April from 12 to 4:30. And that's located on South 7th Street. It's just a block over from the main street, which goes through Upper Sandusky, and I think that's called Sandusky Street. But if you go up north on 23, get off on 199
mm-hmm.
north, and just follow 199, that takes you right downtown Upper Sandusky. And when you get to the center of town, you'll hang a left and go over, and Historical Society's home, it's a beautiful home, is at 130 South 7th Street. But you can't miss it.
Excellent.
And you don't know, just ask anyone. They can point you in the right direction.
I assume that both places have COVID masking restrictions and things.
Obviously, yep, absolutely.
Okay.
And they do have, this is really a preview for the new exhibit space. They've got a lot of new exhibits that they've created over the wintertime, spent a lot of time, as most museums had during the COVID, the severe COVID outbreak, going through their archives and seeing what they had and kind of reconstituting exhibits and changing things around. I know they have a new baseball display up there chronicling the baseball history of Wyandotte County in the area, and there were a number of folks from the Wyandotte County area that went on to play professional baseball, so that should be a very interesting exhibit.
Sounds good.
And I'm also told that they're going to have some local food trucks there. The Mad Canadian Barbecue is going to be there. Soames Brotty Wagon, and Soames Bratwurst made over in Cary, Ohio. Some of the best bratwursts other than Carly's over in Bucyrus that you're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one called Sweets on the Street, and I'm sure that's got a lot of good stuff that we want to eat there. So
probably low-calorie stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure. So we want to patronize the Wyandotte County Historical Society every chance we get. And if you can't make it up for their open house this Saturday, try to stop in and visit them throughout the summer. I'm not sure exactly what their hours are going to be this year, but they do have a website, wyandottehistory.org, and you can check that out. And they have a great group of volunteers up there and a really nice man that's their curator. And I've done a lot of programs up there for them over the years, and it's a really great place. And it's I'm not quite the style of the house built, I think, about in the 1870s. I'm not sure whether it's an Italianate or what it is, but it's a beautiful home, three stories. And they also have a one-room schoolhouse on their property that's just adjacent to the museum itself. And they always have a big July 4th celebration there. They have an ice cream social on the lawn. They have a local community band that comes in and plays patriotic songs and things like that. You get a chance to tour the museum and the one-room schoolhouse and listen to some great music. So,
yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
It is, and I always like to patronize them. As I said, I'm also a member of that organization, and of course spent a number of years working in Wyandotte County in the banking business, so I have a definite love for that group up there, and there's a lot of history there.
Great.
And one other quick mention, the Mohawk Historical Society is still not open. However, should be opening sometime within the next month. Our president, Kim Moore, has been holding off because of COVID.
Sure.
We do have our new building completed now, so now we have three buildings that you can tour when you go up to see the museum, and it's located in beautiful downtown Sycamore at the only blinking traffic light in town. So if you go up Route 23 and go north on 231, that takes you right downtown. You can't miss it. But the museum houses history of the Mohawk School District, which actually takes in parts of three counties, Wyandotte, Crawford, and Seneca. So there's a lot of history in that area, and well worth your time. And again, there's no charge. That's a free museum.
I like that,
I'm sorry?
I like that a lot.
Yeah, and if you're interested in joining, you can do that while you're there, and that's only $10 a year, and you get six beautiful newsletters throughout the year that have information that are gleaned from old newspapers throughout the entire area. And there's also a lot of oftentimes Marion County news in there as well because of the contiguous county part with Wyandotte County. So
now we're only about 1 minute away from the break, but I wanted to ask you, do you keep track of how many people you get into the Marion Historical Society?
Yeah, they do. They do. And I can't tell you offhand. Of course, last year was down because we weren't open much. But we get a lot of traffic through there. It's in the thousands.
Well, fantastic.
Yep.
Well, we will try to continue to tell people about it.
We'll come back with the Hundley.
Yes, and remind us, we still have 30 seconds left to go. Remind us, just so we have food for thought while we're on our little break.
Yes.
What was the Hundley? Now, I know, but...
The Hundley was a Confederate submarine.
There you go.
I love it.
Kind of scary to think about that people would go down in the 1860s. Yes. All right. Well, we're going to have a break here in about 10 seconds, I think. Some days it goes, some days it does not. So,
well, if it doesn't, we'll go right on.
Right. Hang with me. We got 3 seconds until that.
Okay.
Aha. It sounds like we aren't going to get a break.
Okay, well, we can start
let's go with the Hundley.
I'm going to start by reading an excerpt from a book that was written in 2008 by a gentleman by the name of Tom Chafin. And it was one of the, if not the only book that was written on the H.L. Hundley. And this is a quote from the cover flap of his book.
Okay.
And this kind of sets the stage, and then we'll get into a little more detail after that. On the evening of February the 17th, 1864, the Confederacy's H.L. Hundley sank the Union's formidable sloop of war, the USS Housatonic, and became the first submarine in world history to sink an enemy ship. Not until World War I, a half a century later, would a submarine again accomplish such a feat. But also perishing that moonlight night, vanishing beneath the cold Atlantic waters of Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, was the Hundley and her entire crew of eight, three more than had gone down with the Housatonic. For generations, searchers prowled Charleston's harbor looking for the Hundley, and as they hunted, the legends surrounding the boat and its demise continued to grow. Even after the submarine was definitively located in 1995, and recovered 5 years later in the year 2000, those legends, those barnacles of misinformation, have only thickened, and the mystery continues to grow. Go ahead. Did you have questions?
No, I just love that. Whoever wrote that was pretty good.
Well, again, this is a guy by the name of Tom Chafin, and the book is called The H.L. Hundley, The Secret Hope of the Confederacy.
Okay.
Now, one of the reasons why this was so important to develop something like this, and again, we have to hearken back to ancient times, because there were some ideas for submarines that were actually thought of and crudely built as far back as the 15th century. So this isn't a new innovation. However, this is one of the first ones that was proven to actually work. So we have to remember that because the Civil War was going on, and it was actually nearing the end by 1864, but in the beginning of the war, when the war broke out in 61, the Union Army, or the Union Navy, set up blockades in Charleston Harbor. And that was, of course, to prevent the Confederacy, or the Confederate States of America, from receiving any kind of aid, whether it be ammunition, arms, or even food sources. Country of England at that time, our old British Empire, was supporting the Southern states. So one of the ways that they were trying to support the states in the beginning of the war was by shipping materials that the Confederacy needed and couldn't provide for themselves from England. And of course, you have to remember, Glenn, when the war broke out, most of the industry was, of course, occurring up north.
Except for cotton.
And of course, that's what the South was primarily known for.
Cotton and tobacco,
in those days.
Yeah.
Producing cotton, producing tobacco.
Yeah.
And those things, of course, you can't eat.
Yeah.
So they were getting a lot of their food sources that weren't being grown on small farms in the South. Well, obviously, coming from the northern states. And things like ammunition, arms, just anything in general that had to do with industry or manufacturing was coming from the north. So you can imagine when the southern states started to secede, and we became two separate countries, so to speak, they were kind of in a world of hurt.
Yeah.
In fact, even their railroad system in the south was not as intricate and involved as the railroad system was in the northern states. So they really didn't have much of a way to move things around the southern states, with the exception of river traffic and over the land. So obviously, when the North decided to blockade Charleston Harbor I think it didn't start until about 1862 with the blockade, by that time things got pretty serious for the southern states. So they had to come up with a way to try to get ships in. So, obviously, the only other thing they could do was go all the way around to the southern tip of the Gulf of Mexico and try to bring things in through New Orleans, which even there was being blockaded to some extent. Not as great as what Charleston Harbor was, because that was a little more convenient coming from England and being on the eastern seaboard. They didn't have to go all the way down around Florida, in between Florida and Cuba, which, again, provided a problem for ships in those days, because you got to remember, most of them were sailing vessels. There were some steam-powered ships, but a lot of them were sailing vessels. And that distance, or that area between Florida and Cuba and that whole area of the Bermuda Triangle and the Gulf of Mexico, as we know today and from past experience over the last several years, horrific hurricanes naturally that occur in that area. So that provided another problem for the ships getting from England to that particular harbor. So they needed to come up with some way to get rid of those Union ships in the harbor and open that up. Now, the Union not only had ships in that harbor blocking the southern states from getting anything from England, but they also were using mines. And I'm sure a lot of people don't realize
that
mines were even being used during the Civil War. And they were floating mines that just floated slightly below the surface with a small trigger that would stick up, but particularly hard to see, especially if you're trying to sneak a ship in during the night.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of ships suffered damage trying to sneak in that way from the mines. So it didn't take too long before the southern states knew that the only way they could continue to get what they needed from England to keep sustaining the war was to find out a way to eliminate those ships. And that's where the idea of the submarine came up.
Huh. Now, didn't Leonardo da Vinci, didn't he design a diving bell, but it was more, it was kind of a submarine.
Absolutely, yeah. And that really is the beginning of that type of research. And, and again, that's occurring back in the 1500s, the 14th century, something like that, 14th, 15th century. So we're talking several hundred years before this.
Yeah.
So the Hanle itself, talk a little bit about what it looked like. It was a kind of a cigar-shaped cylinder made out of metal, presumably iron, because that's basically what they were dealing with in those days, iron and some sort of a pot metal. You know, they did have forges that were working. But it was a cigar-shaped type design. It was 40 feet long, again, made entirely of metal. It did have a like a conning tower that set to the rear of the ship that had two glass portals or portholes, viewing areas. Actually, the only thing that would let any light into the ship, and also provide the man that was guiding the ship with a tiller, it was only to provide him, you know, what he could see ahead of him if it were daylight.
Sure, they were
submerged, he might be able to see if it wasn't too bad, but that was the only light that was coming in.
Well, surely it wasn't able to go down very deep because of the glass that they'd have in those windows would it burst, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, and again, we don't know just exactly how deep it could go because, as we'll soon find out, it never resurfaced. They did do some experiments with the ship before they actually put it into use. And from what I've been able to read, around 20 feet seemed to be where they were going. Which, when you stop and think what they were going to use this for, 20 feet would have been
really
beyond what they would have needed to go.
Sure.
Because what they're going to be trying to do is attack a ship that is sitting in the water, drawing water probably only about 8 to 10 feet.
Right.
So, and most of these large sailing vessels or these large ships that were being used to block the harbor would have sat about 8 to 10 feet low in the water.
Was there an aggressive move to ram the ship, or did they plant bombs on
them? No. Moving on, there was an 8-man crew,
okay.
I think I mentioned earlier.
Continue.
And there was a long cylinder that ran down through the center of the ship and went to the rear of the ship, and that was connected to the propeller blades. And if you kind of think of it this way, there were seven men that sat on one side of this long tube or arm, and I'm motioning with my hands. That ran down through the center of the sub. And if you have to kind of think about how a bicycle works with pedals, right?
Okay.
So the pedals drive the chain, and that turns the gears, which make the wheels move.
Mm-hmm.
So the same kind of basic theory here with this long shaft that runs down through the center has a series of pedals on it. There are seven men that sit on the same side. Each man has a set of pedals, just like a set of bicycle pedals, and they pedal in unison.
Mm-hmm.
And as they pedal in unison, that turns the propellers, which makes the ship go forward.
Gotcha.
Isn't it that's pretty ingenious?
It is very ingenious.
And then
yes.
The captain of the ship sits on like a higher up seat or perch, where he can see out of the two glass portals, and he has a tiller, just like a tiller on a boat, that allows him to steer the direction that the tail blade, would move. If the propellers are just slightly inside that tail blade, and then the shaft runs through the propellers, turns the propellers, and then also then his tiller can move that blade back and forth. So if he wants to go left, right, or straight, you know, just move the tiller somewhat. So it's 40 feet long, as we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It was made out of iron. Now, you wanted to know, were they going to ram or what?
Yeah.
All right. There's a long metal spar attached to the front of the ship. That's just kind of like a long metal pole.
You have a mechanical narwhal, then.
Yeah, exactly. And this spar is 16 feet long.
Oh, wow.
Now, what they would do, they developed a mine that was in the shape of a barrel, kind of like a the size of a beer keg in those days, maybe hold, 10, 20 gallon of beer.
Okay.
And this was made of copper. And inside this keg or this barrel was 135 pounds of black powder.
Ooh.
And there was a trigger inside made of fulminated mercury.
Whew.
Of course, that was when that was going to be the charge that set off the black powder.
It sounds
now
dangerous.
You can imagine how touchy.
Yeah. Very dangerous.
Dealing with this.
Yeah.
So this barrel or mine is attached to the end of this spar, and the idea is when the submarine approaches the ship that it wants to blow up, just below the water line, it goes right up to the edge, and on the front of this barrel are three prongs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the prongs are metal with a point on them, and as the ship approaches the submarine, they hit the side of the submarine, and the prongs stick into the side of the wooden hull.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Now, as they pull back, when they pull back, that releases the mine, or the beer keg.
Uh-huh.
The beer keg sticks to the side of the ship's hull, and as they pull back, that releases the switch inside, which sets off the lighted charge. Now, they've got 16 feet distance between them and the side of that ship.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to pull back as quickly as they can.
I would
16
guess.
Feet's not that far back.
Yeah, I would guess fast.
So
yes.
Ideally, when they pull back, the charge sets off the fulminated mercury. That lights the black powder, and the black powder explodes. Blows a gigantic hole in the ship, the Houstonic, and of course it sets the ship into motion of sinking.
I'm starting to see why they didn't return from this dive.
Well, so the first thing you think about is what in your mind, what do you think happens after they pull back and the explosion occurs? What do you think happens?
Well, I imagine there's quite a shock wave that jostles the submarine around and could just shake it loose, causing lots of leaks.
So here's the thing.
Okay.
The ship obviously did its job. It blew a hole in the Houstonic. The Houstonic sunk, but the Hunley never returned.
You better watch out, because if it's sinking fast, it might sink on you.
That's true. Remember, 16 feet, and there's no way you could delay the explosion. The minute you pulled back, that set off the fulminated mercury, which set off the charge and blew the ship up. So you only had 16 feet distance between you and that explosion. So a number
right.
of things could have happened, right? But here's the thing. The Hunley never returned.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't know what happened to it. And again, this is 1864.
Jeez.
February of 1864.
And most of those ships, that ship that they were attacking was at least 30 feet wide.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
guessing
absolutely.
50
yeah,
feet
quite,
wide
I
easily.
Just, I couldn't find the dimensions of the Houstonic,
yeah.
but I'm thinking that they were average-sized sailing ships.
So if it sank on the narwhale's little gnar, it could have just trapped them down there.
It could have.
Yeah.
It could have if they couldn't have pulled back fast enough.
Yeah. yeah.
But with it not returning, they had no idea what happened to it.
Yeah.
Now, this occurred in 1864.
I would have thought that they would have designed some method for the crew to get out in case they were trapped down.
Well, there was only one hatch that
yeah.
went in and out, and it did have ballast. They were smart enough to know what ballast was and
yeah.
had ballast tanks filled, of course, to sink them. And they could release ballast to make them rise.
Yeah.
But from 1864 until 1995, it was missing.
Oh.
The submarine
was
missing.
Well, they didn't have any opportunity to look at it.
Well, they didn't for a number of years.
Yeah.
But from about 1960 on, they started searching
uh-huh.
for the ship, for the submarine.
Yeah.
And
that was probably a really terrific reality show on TV.
Well, actually, there's been a couple of PBS specials about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until 1995, after years of searching the Charleston Harbor, that it was finally discovered. Now, here's something that if you're a reader, and if you're a reader of fiction, you'll recognize this name.
Okay.
Does the name Clive Cussler ring
no,
a bell?
No, I'm not a reader of fiction. So.
Okay. Clive Cussler is a fiction writer. Just passed away, I think, last year. Probably has written hundreds of books over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fiction reader either, but a real good friend of mine is. Mm-hmm. And Clive Cussler has written a lot of novels based on historical events. And one of his novels, I guess, talks about the Hunley. And I didn't know it until I started reading about the Hunley about 10, 15 years ago, that it was Clive Cussler's group that found the Hunley in Charleston Harbor. So here's an author of fiction that has an interest in history that is the one that after, 100 plus years, ran across the Hunley in 1995.
Hmm. Now, was he looking for it, or was it an accident?
Yeah, oh, okay. They were looking for it. He had been providing the financial support for a group known as the Friends of the Hunley, mm-hmm. who had been relentlessly trying to find it in the Charleston Harbor for all those years. Now, if you know anything about harbors, obviously they have to be dredged periodically.
Yes.
And they constantly fill up with mud and silt. Mm-hmm. So when they finally discovered it was buried. It was buried in mud and silt. And about the only thing, from what I understand, that was visible was this little conning tower. That's the only way they knew it was there.
Hmm.
So they finally locate it after all these years, and thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of money spent trying to find it. They're able to raise it in the year 2000.
Hmm.
And I remember when it was raised in the year 2000, it was big news, especially the people that...
I vaguely remember, yeah.
You remember seeing it?
Yeah, I do vaguely remember seeing that, yeah.
It was big news on TV. It was huge news on the History Channel. And right away there were programs. I actually watched it being brought up. It was live. They were live in Charleston Harbor. I don't remember, maybe it was CNN or one of the news channels was there when they actually brought the Hunley up.
I think I'm going to try to get on YouTube and see if I can find that.
I'm sure there's footage of it when they raised it.
Now, is the Hunley spelled Huntley or is it Hundley?
It's H-U-N-L-E-Y.
Oh,
Hunley.
There's no D or T.
There's no D,
okay.
No D or T, either one.
All right.
The H-L Hunley. So, of course, obviously, after they got the ship or the submarine raised, they immediately had to get it into protective area because it had been laying in salt water all those years. So,
yeah.
You know, once it starts being introduced to the atmosphere, the corrosion is going to start
sure.
right away. So they'd already prepared a large tank, and I think it's in Atlanta. I've forgotten now. I wrote it down, and I can't find my car where I wrote it down. But they had a big tank specifically built that they could immediately move it in a protective tank.
Yeah, they had to put it back into salt water,
right,
probably.
Right,
yeah.
The tank that they had built, and it's on a campus of one of the universities. I'm not sure if it's in Atlanta or where it is, and it's in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they got it to the tank, and they started resubmerged it back into salt water. So since then, since 2000, they have been meticulously working on cleaning and trying to get on the inside because the inside was also totally filled
mm-hmm.
with silt and mud.
Yeah.
Now, there were no breaches in the ship. There were no tears in the ship.
Well, then
no
how
breaches.
Did the mud and silt get in there?
Not quite sure.
The
hatch was not opened. And here's the fascinating part. When they finally did get everything cleaned out, there were 8 skeletons in the ship in their exact positions with their hands on the pedals.
Huh.
And the man at the tiller with his hand on the tiller.
Huh.
So here's what, this new book that just came out called In the Waves, written by Rachel Lance, My Quest to Solve the Mystery of a Civil War Submarine. Because right off the top of your mind, you're thinking, okay, the minute that explosion occurs, that explosion breaches that sub, and it fills with water and sinks.
Yeah.
Everybody drowns.
But we know it didn't.
But we know now it didn't.
Yeah.
But that's the first thing you're thinking of.
Well, the concussion could have killed them all, maybe.
And that's the theory that this Rachel Lance is leaning on right now. And I'm only about halfway through the book, but what I've managed to because I'm reading like four books at a time here. This is my nemesis. I read these books.
I wish I had your desire like that.
But what she's leaning toward, and I guess they've done a lot of research with, they've done testing, independent testing. She's done independent testing. But what the theory is that they're coming up with now is that when the blast occurred, it sent this shockwave back through the submarine, which immediately caused their lungs to create these massive internal blood clots that blew.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there was apparently no damage to the body. It was instant death. Huh. In other words, they didn't even have time to think about going to the hatch or releasing the ballast or even getting up. It's like they just sat there and died.
But why would it have sunk? Well, I guess they had released the ballast to get them down there anyway.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
They had full ballast tanks. So obviously it settled on down to the bottom when it started to fill with water and silt.
Wow.
Now, where it came from, there must have been some breach in the rivets is the only thing, small breaches. Maybe it took, who knows, it might have taken
years.
A year for it to fill up.
Sure.
With water and silt and mud.
And an explosion like that would probably loosen the joints.
Oh, I would be no doubt in my mind.
And if they didn't get it backed off far enough, the explosion would have been jarring beyond belief.
Right, and with only a 16-foot spar, with only seconds, once you release that spar from that mine, you've got literally probably 3 seconds before that black powder is going to ignite. 135 pounds of black powder. That's a lot of black powder.
When you said
you
that.
You know, in a barrel the size of a beer barrel, that's a lot of black powder. That's going to create one heck of an explosion. I mean, I can't even imagine, being a Civil War reenactor and working with black powder firearms, you're using a minuscule amount to set off a charge at a rifle or a handgun. Can you imagine what 135 pounds would do?
A lot.
Because what you're using in a handgun or a rifle is a fraction of a tenth of an ounce or less, just a few grains sometimes. You're only counting out like maybe 15, 18, 20 grains. So when you start to think what 135 pounds of black powder would do, it isn't any wonder that that the concussion would have killed them.
Well, when they brought it up, did they give all 8 or 9 of the skeletons purple hearts?
I'm not sure whether they were given a purple heart or not, since they were part of the Confederate States of America.
That's right,
Army.
They were the raw team.
But when it got to the point where they could remove the skeletons, they were all giving a military
oh, well, that's
a burial. Now, the captain of the ship was a guy by the name of Horace Lawson Hunley. That's where the ship got its name.
Oh, okay.
From the captain of the
Did
ship.
Did he pay for it?
He was actually a lieutenant in the Confederate States Navy. And he was a 37-year-old attorney, when the war broke out. And that's where he got his commission, obviously, from being, a college graduate and an attorney.
Yeah, okay.
But that's where the ship got its name. There were a number of people that worked on the design. Interestingly enough, you can actually go there and tour the facility.
Huh.
The way they have it set up now, it's like a living type museum. And I can't remember where they buried the seamen. Naval officer and seaman that were on board, but they, as I said, they were given a full military honors.
So, can you actually look inside the Hunley itself?
I'm sorry.
Can you actually look inside the hull?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think they just have photographs that you can see. Because it is submerged in salt water. There really wouldn't be much of a way to see in it.
Yeah, unless they had cameras.
I don't do computers, so I haven't gone online to see. There's probably a virtual tour.
Uh-huh.
That you could take, and she may even talk about that towards the end of the book. But I'm only about a halfway through the book. But
next month when you and I talk, I will have looked at it, and I'll tell you.
Now, there you go. And again, I remember seeing a couple of PBS specials, and I think maybe there was one that was done by the History Channel on the Hunley.
Huh. Okay.
As well, but you know, it's a fascinating story. And when you mentioned that they were starting to use submarines during the Civil War, people had a hard time grasping that,
yeah.
Because you know, we're talking the 1860s. However, you know, they did have ironclad ships.
Yes, they did.
During the Civil War, all the two that come to mind that people talk about, obviously, all the time, is the Monitor and the Merrimack, which
yep.
took on each other on different occasions. But there were a number of ironclad ships that the Union Navy operated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the Confederacy had more than one or two, but that was something that the Union Army was experimenting with actually long before the Civil War started out, because they were starting to use ironclads on the high seas.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a fascinating story, and again, we've just barely touched on the surface of the thing, kind of given the nuts and bolts of how the ship was built and what caused its demise. But when you start to think about it, it was a pretty fantastic idea at the time to devise that type of a way to attach a mine to a ship to blow it up.
Yeah. Now, as a little boy, I was digging under snow in South Bend, Indiana. We had a huge snow, and I dug a tunnel, and I could go through it and come out the other side. Well, it caved in on me, and I've had claustrophobia ever since. I cannot imagine how the gentleman did not have claustrophobia.
Well,
in that.
You know, 40 feet's not very long.
Yeah.
And when you're putting 8 men in an area 40 feet long, that doesn't. And there are some illustrations in the books that show that how close they were together.
Well, I imagine they didn't have much headroom either.
No,
they
no.
were sitting,
and,
right?
And the other thing is, there couldn't be a whole lot of oxygen.
No. Absolutely not.
So their time underwater obviously would have been short if everything had gone well.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. They couldn't have suffocated. They had to die instantly, because if they were lacking oxygen and were, you know, how you would try to claw it, trying to get out,
right.
You'd be up all over that place,
yes.
Even though it was small. You'd be trying to claw your way out, get to that hatch, try to open that hatch.
Right.
Something. Let the ballast tanks go. Try to get yourself out of there. So it's obviously that they died instantaneously.
Yeah, if they had not died instantaneously, and they could have gotten to the hatch, if they were only 40 feet down, that wouldn't kill them.
If they could have gotten the hatch open.
Oh my goodness.
If there was enough pressure on the hatch, they may not have even been able to get it open.
But sure.
It's a fascinating subject. Again, the two books are the H.L. Hunley,
mm-hmm.
The Secret Hope of the Confederacy, written by Tom Chafin. That was 2008. And then 2020, In the Waves, written by Rachel Lance, just came out. Her quest to solve the mystery of a Civil War submarine.
Well, fantastic. We're down to 15 seconds, and then
okay.
We'll do our next 45 minutes. But thanks a lot, and we'll be right back after we take about a 15-minute break.
See you on the other side.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to WWDH Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion, Ohio.